welcome to episode 57 of this podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Grigg, and I'm joined today by that master of logododdly, Perry Middlemiss.
Ooh. Hello, yes, David.
Logododdly is wizardry with words.
Oh.
Wizardry with words.
No, I think that's more applicable to you than me.
No.
Verbal diarrhea, I think, is what I've got. No, none of this. I'm trying to work at it. I'm trying to get a bit better at it. Trying to do a bit more writing and get a bit better at it. But, you know, I was a bit like you, I guess, that most of the writing that I did during my professional career was bland business English.
Mm.
Oh, God. It's, you know, you look back on that and you look at that and you read it now and you think, well, yeah, I know what a point I was trying to get across, but, you know, I'm glad I don't have to write like that every day, all day.
No, that's right.
I had to do it for about 30-odd years, and that was quite long enough. Thank you. So writing reviews, essays about things that you actually like is a lot better than having to sort of wade your way through interminable text about projects that you can't see the point of and you really don't want to be involved in.
No.
Now, it can get rather disconcerting and disheartening, but
don't need to
do that anymore, which is a good thing.
That's good.
So what have you been up to? I know we're in lockdown and we've just had our lockdown extended, but
it's
cold, wet, wintry day, so the listener might hear a little bit of rain hitting the corrugated iron roof.
It's the same here, except we don't have a corrugated iron roof, but love might still hear it outside.
So,
yes, it's a little bit cold, but it's all right. It's all right. It would be better if it wasn't for the fact that my brother has just moved to Queensland and is sending me photos of them down the beach and, you know, enjoying the sun up there and having a great old time. So, never mind.
Well, I've got three or four friends who are at the moment who took off to Port Douglas for a week about a week ago. And have now got themselves caught in a lockdown, which means they have to stay there for another week.
Oh, dear, what a pity.
What a pity. And given that they're all retired, they really don't care. My trouble is I do care, and I really wish they wouldn't keep telling me how good it is up there. Because, of course, they haven't got a lockdown. They can get out and go out and do whatever they want. So they're out snorkeling and going out on boats and going down the pub for a nice quiet beer, and we just sit here and quietly cry.
Oh, we'll get over it. We will.
Yeah. Hopefully by the time we hit spring and the weather picks up, we'll be able to get back out there and do a few things, which will be good. In the meantime, we can talk about books.
Yeah, what a good thing to talk about.
What a good thing to talk about. A couple of things I wanted to mention first off is regarding a number of awards that have been handed down or announced in the last couple of weeks that might be of interest to our listener. The first of these was the Miles Franklin Award, which was announced last Thursday, I think it was.
Yep.
That was won by The Labyrinth by Amanda Lowry, which is interesting because that's a book I talked about only 2 weeks ago in this very place.
Yep. That's right.
And so the Miles Franklin Award is the major Australian literary award. It's been running since the late 50s. It was created as a result of a trust that came out of the will of Miles Franklin, who wrote My Brilliant Career, amongst many other works, and is given to a novel by an Australian writer, but that's actually not correct. You don't actually have to be an Australian writer to win this award or even be nominated. I believe there has been only one book nominated that was written by a non-Australian writer, but it was based on a historical Australian incident, and it was about people being shipped from the UK or Britain out to Australia. Might have been in the convict period, but it was written by an English writer whose name now completely escapes me. But I'll have to look that up at some point if we ever get back around to talking about the Miles Franklin Award. But it is supposed to be for books that concern the Australian way of life,
yes.
And this really does. And I was very happy to see that it won. And I spoke to Chong about it. And I said, because, of course, our friend Chong did the cover. And I said, oh, I suppose the champagne is flowing in at Text Publishing at the moment. And he said, well, yes, it is virtually. Because they're based in Melbourne. They were all locked down. They couldn't get together. So they all had a big Zoom meeting and were toasting each other with champagne. But a bit unfortunate that they can't get together and have a good time. But maybe after all this is over, they can do that. The next award that I wanted to mention was the International Thriller Award, which is given out by the International Thriller Writers each year. It seems to make sense. It was won by Blacktop Wasteland by S.A. Crosby, which I reviewed at the end of last year.
Oh, you've obviously got good taste.
I just seem to be able to pick them for some reason. I'm not sure why, but just seem to be able to do that. And the last one is the Steel Dagger Award, which was awarded to When She Was Good by Michael Rowbotham. Mm-hmm. This one's given out by the British Crime Writers Association, and this is one of that you covered, David.
Yeah, I talked about it with the prequel of that, I suppose, which is Good Girl, Bad Girl. The two together sort of make a unit, I think, so that's why I talked about them together. But it's interesting to see that the second one won.
Yeah, well, this is the Steel Dagger Award. This is for thriller writing. It's not the Gold Dagger, which is considered to be the top-of-the-line award for that particular association, but Rowbotham's won at least one or two Gold Dagger awards in the past, so he's doing very well. The Brits and Europeans do seem to like his work,
and he keeps cranking him out, which is good.
Well, he does. Yes, he's rather consistent, about one a year or so that's not too bad. Okay, well, the major reason why we are talking today, David, and the major subject that we wanted to cover was to have a look at the Hugo Award novella nominees for this year, for 2021. These are the long short fiction, if you like, 17,500 to 40,000 word stories that are going to be awarded at this year's Worldcon, Discon 3, which is going to be held in Washington, D.C. in December this year. So we've got a bit of time to work our way through each of the categories. So we thought we'd start off with the novella because, well, I pushed you a bit because I'd finished reading them all. And I asked you to have a look at a couple of them. So so we thought we'd just work our way through that list and give people a bit of an idea of what's on the ballot. And also give a bit of an idea of what I think I would like to see win and what I think will win, because it's not necessarily the same thing.
Hmm.
Anyway, the first one that I'm going to deal with is a novella called Upright Women Wanted by Sarah Gailey. Now, this is a novella set sometime in an indeterminate future in the USA, which is fragmented into various political and religious segments, something after post-apocalyptic. People have sort of, well, technology and transport has basically collapsed. Information is strictly controlled by the various governments in these different religious segments, and that information is spread across the countryside by authorized librarians. And this is librarians with a capital L, because it's a sort of an association of librarians. And this is an all-woman, nun-like organisation that's been set up and is authorised by the governments to be able to spread just pamphlets, books, propaganda around to the countryside, so that if the government wants to spread around a note about a new law that they've put out, they get the librarians to do so. They travel from town to town. Travellers by horse and wagon. And the feel of this world is like the old West, basically. It's just, you know, everybody's basically got guns, and it's pretty much the old West transported somewhere into the future.
Right.
The main character here, Esther Augustus, stows away with these librarians after her best friend is executed for accessing unapproved material. Mm. And she eventually joins the group and becomes an apprentice to to the three or four people or three or four women that are already there. And then they find her in the wagon and basically decide, well, they can't really get rid of her. And while she's there, she might as well show what she's good at. And they get her to say, we'll put you in as a bookbinder. Well, what's that? Well, it's somebody who mends books. Oh, okay. Here's a book, see if you can mend it. And she does a really, really good job of it. Okay. She's quite an excellent little bookbinder. And so they take her on as an apprentice. And the story basically follows her adventures with the librarians. Now, this is essentially a Western with political overtones. And you quickly determine that the librarians are basically an insurrectionist organisation. With possible modern-day metaphors aside, it concentrates far too much on the romantic side of things rather than the political element. I mean, Esther just basically seems to fall in lust with every woman that she sees in this particular story at the drop of a hat. And it starts getting to the point where you think, oh, okay, so let's... So I sat back from this a little bit. I thought, okay, let's get rid of that. Let's just say that this would have been, let's get rid of the romantic element of this. Let's just look at the story as it actually is. There's not a lot here, really. Mm. I mean, it's interesting and amusing, but not really that great. You sort of have to wonder why it was nominated. But it is. Obviously, there's a group of people that like this type of stuff, and they think that the overt lesbian romance is the thing that carries the story. I don't. Not that I'm against it. I just don't think that this one's got enough to be really on the ballot. I think there are other things around which were much better than this. Anyway, I gave this one 3.4 out of 5. I was, okay. It was just a so-so one as far as I was concerned.
I see. Fair enough. All right. Well, I'll go on to my first one. And this is probably the one that's going to win, I would say. Certainly, to infect one nebula for this length of story. And this is Ring Shout by P. DeGelly Clark. So I have to start by admitting my white Anglo-Saxon privilege here, because this is a story which speaks strongly to the experience of African Americans, both in the past and today. And without my having had that experience, I feel there's certainly something missing in my response, because I really didn't much like it, as we'll see. Leaving all that aside, I have to look at this just as a story. And for me, I have to say that it didn't work for me just on the basis of storytelling. So the story is set in 1922 in Macon, Georgia, and it begins with a march of the Ku Klux Klan through the streets. It's told from the first-person point of view of a character called Maurice Boudreau, and she and her team of African-American women, all of whom seem to be in their 20s or 30s, they're readying an attack. And they're not attacking the human marchers, as you might first think, but they're attacking this group of four Ku Kluxes, who we discover are monsters with backward-bending legs, six eyes and claws, and a bony white head, which comes to a sharp point. It fits neatly into the Ku Klux Klan uniform, I suppose, costume. So that's the basic premise, that the humans who join the Ku Klux Klan are either transformed, so we're not totally clear to me, either transformed into these monsters for the force of their hate, or else that the group's been infiltrated by aliens or perhaps demons who were shaped like this. It's not quite clear to me which of those is right. Now, a notoriously racist film, The Birth of a Nation, directed by D.W. Griffith, was released in 1915 and is credited with the revival of the Klan. It was based on a book by Thomas Dixon Jr. Now, that's all historically true, factually correct. But in the novella, we're told that Dixon and his father were powerful sorcerers, and that at a showing of the movie at Stone Mountain, east of Atlanta, William Joseph Simmons, the founder of the Second Coming of the Ku Klux Klan, read aloud from a book of conjuring written on human skin. It was this which called up the monsters that Maurice and her compatriots call Ku Kluxes. So it's a clever sort of premise, but I do wonder if that doesn't downplay the fact that ordinary human beings don't seem to have any trouble becoming moral monsters without the need for any external demonic influence. It's a bit like the common idea in many works of fiction that the Nazis were invoking black magic and were in league with satanic forces during the Second World War. Anyway, leaving that aside for the moment, Maurice and her team set a trap baited by a cooked dog, which apparently attracts these Ku Kluxes, and they blow up four of these monsters. They aren't quite dead, though, and just at the point where Maurice appears to be doomed as they attack her, she spirits up a magical sword out of thin air and slashes the monsters to bits. Okay, very convenient. We eventually learn this sword has been gifted to Maurice by a group of aunties who are, I'm not sure, they're a group of aliens or spirits with generally human form, but with fox-like features hidden behind masks made of human skin. Not sure where they come from. Then we have a quest that Maurice undertakes to try to get help from yet another group of beings, the Night Doctors. It's really at that point that I started to become a bit impatient with the whole story. There are just too many moving parts which aren't really explained, and the story, to me, just didn't seem to have any coherence. There are lots of battles with the Ku Kluxes and their still human supporters, who are led by a big white man called Butcher Clyde. He looks human at first, but in her dreams, and when she's able to see him properly close up, he appears to be made up of hundreds of small creatures, each with a hungry, gaping mouth and jagged teeth. So he's not a Ku Klux, he's just another kind of monster. So there's a climactic battle on Stone Mountain, where the birth of a nation is being shown yet again, as Butcher Clyde uses a gathering of clan members to call up a huge monster called the Grand Cyclops. There's one good bit there, I thought, where Butcher Clyde and the Cyclops try to recruit Maurice, not to the cause of the whites, which they, in fact, care nothing for, but to the cause of hate, to arm her with the power of hate to use on the side of her own people. And her response is, well, I guess, you know, you'd expect this response, given that she's the sort of hero of the story. She's tempted for a moment, but then decisively rejects him and the cult of hate. The battle continues, and the forces of the good guys are struggling. All appears to be lost before the cavalry arrives in the form of the Night Doctors and a host of human ghosts. The battle is won and the bad guys are routed. But that's not the end of it, of course. This is only 1922. Much more remains to be done. Look, I'm almost certainly the wrong audience for this, but it just didn't work for me. It just didn't hang together coherently enough as a story or, to me, make a clear point. Are we supposed to forgive those joining the Ku Klux Klan and carrying out hateful attacks on colored people because they've been entranced by demonic magic and infiltrated by alien monsters? Surely that's not the point the author's trying to make. But if it isn't, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to take from it. I didn't like it. Sorry. What do you think of it?
No, that's fine. No. I go along with a lot of what you basically said. I thought that the whole thrust of the story just set out to undermine itself with the idea that, well, it's not really the whites' fault. They've been... it's a case of demonic possession. Well,
yeah.
I'm sorry, yeah, I don't know why people haven't picked this up. I mean, I would have thought they would have, as soon as that came up, I thought, no, what is he doing? What is he trying to say here? And I couldn't get to it. I just didn't figure out what he was going on about. It seemed to be excusing the Ku Klux Klan members rather than condemning them.
Yeah,
so it completely undermined its own premise, as far as I was concerned. So,
yeah, anyway,
not happy. Anyway, I'll move on to another one. This is Riot Baby by Tochi Onibuchi. My apologies if I've mispronounced that. This is a novella nominated for the 2021 Locus Hugo and Nebula Awards, so it was pretty popular across all three of those. Concerns a young woman and a younger brother. Ella is the name of the young woman who's got a telekinetic power that she's struggling to control. And her younger brother, Kev, who's the riot baby of the novella's title, is born in the middle of the riots following the beating of Rodney King in 1991 by LAPD officers. Now, their lives as African-Americans in the late 20th and early 21st centuries are both hard and brutal. They live in poverty and they just struggle all the way through. Kev is eventually imprisoned for supposedly his role in an armed robbery, although we're never really terribly sure whether he's been stitched up or whether he actually did take part in it or not. And meanwhile, Ella has slowly begun to get her powers under control, to the extent that she can see into the future and as well into the past. So she's able to sort of project herself into both. So she can look at the various future outcomes and look back into the past. And when she visits Kev, if she touches him, she's able to temporarily transport him to other places as well. And some of these that she takes him to are good and some of them are bad. She takes him back to when he was born and back through his earlier life and also into possible futures. This is another angry novella. You can understand why. It does have a reason for it. I mean, it is trying to give a view of the African-American experience. And to my mind, works a lot better doing that than Ring Shout. While it's angry, it keeps itself under control. It doesn't actually lose track of things. And it does end on a note of hope that black Americans can gain the power that white Americans currently have, not to control them, but to live in a form of harmony and peace. And you sort of get a feeling that there's a sense of hope that's coming out of this. I thought this was second or third best of the whole lot, I think. Mm-hmm. I certainly thought it was better than Ring Shout, because I thought Ring Shout just, as I said, undermined itself. This one at least is consistent and it carries its way through. It's got a sense of hope to it at the end. And I gave this one a 4.1 out of 5, but I only gave 3.8 to Ring Shout. So
there you go. Oh, well, interesting, isn't it? Yes, I'm interested reading these novellas because I haven't read much modern science fiction recently.
Well, so the interesting thing,
it's good to catch up.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about novellas, as I've said in the past, that I think that it's probably one of the better lengths for science fiction. And you get a lot of really interesting material that comes out here. But I think as we get through to the end of this, that I'll be able to mention two themes to you pretty quickly when we get through to the end of this. But let's carry on.
Let's see
how
we go.
So what's your next one?
My next one is Come Tumbling Down by Seanan Maguire. Apparently that's how you pronounce her name. Seanan. And I quite enjoyed this. It's a pretty entertaining novella or short novel for young adults, I would say. This one follows on closely from the first book in this series, of which this is, I think, the fifth.
Yep.
So it follows on from the first book, which is Every Heart a Doorway, in that it focuses on two important characters out of that book. And these are the identical twins, Jack and Jill, whose full names are Jacqueline and Jillian. Jack and Jill, so you can see where the title comes from. Jack and Jill. Now, Jack and Jill, although they're identical twins, they're identical in appearance, they're very different in character. Jack, surly and difficult, is into gruesome science experiments, and Jill is into flimsy lace and airy thoughts. Now, it's quite a while since I read Every Heart a Doorway, and I recall not being very impressed by it the first time I read it. But I have to say that reading this one has now given me the urge to go back and reread that first book and maybe reassess what I thought about it. So the premise of the series is really quite an interesting one. So we have a secluded school, which is called Eleanor West's Home for Wayward Children. And it's supposedly a school dealing with difficult teenagers, but it is in fact set up to take in young people, each of whom at an earlier period in their lives has discovered a portal that took them into a different world. Each child has entered a world which somehow resonates with their own needs and natures, and these worlds are very varied in type. The key thing, though, is that each child at the school has been forced to leave their portal world and is now forced to live in the, quote, real world, with almost no one believing their fantastic stories of where they've been, perhaps for years, been missing for years, maybe. Except the head of the school, Eleanor West, who herself was such a child, and that's why she set up the school. Now, I'm going to have to give away spoilers for Every Heart a Doorway, because otherwise it's almost impossible to talk about this book. So if you still want to read the first book, you might want to skip this next bit. So towards the end of the first book, there's been a series of killings going on. It's discovered that of these two twins, Jill has been killing other students. in a desperate quest to try and find her way back into her portal world. Sorry, her and Jack's portal world called the Moors, a world we discover which is ruled by vampires and mad scientists. And the attempt by Jill to open this doorway works. But Jack, who is appalled by Jill's actions, stabs her dead and carries her body through the doorway at the end of that first book. Now, you need all of that background to understand that at the beginning of this book, one of the twins returns. She's carried in the arms of a woman who appears unable to speak. The body that she's carrying isn't dead, however, and it begins to revive. But is it the decent but difficult scientist Jack, or is it the serial killer Jill? Both, it turns out. In the Moors, Jack had been able to resurrect her sister Jill. You know, mad scientists, remember, so they can resurrect people. But lacking any gratitude, Jill, with the aid of her vampire master, have somehow managed to swap bodies with Jack, to swap their minds or swap the bodies, whatever you like to say. Now, you'd think that since they're identical twins, this wouldn't matter much, but you'd be wrong. And so the story becomes an adventure where Jack and some of her fellow students return to the Moors, and they battle Jill and the Master in order to regain Jack's body and defeat the forces of evil. Doing so is, however, of course, not straightforward. You know, this was, I thought, a lot of fun, if you don't take it too seriously. It was entertaining enough, but I did feel that there was rather too much talking than action, and that the climactic final battle was pretty poorly handled. It really didn't let the tension build up very much before it was all over and the good guys won. However, it did make me feel that I should go back and read some of the other episodes in this series that I missed. So there we are. That's what I thought.
Yeah, I thought that with a few of these that are in this particular series, it's called the Wayward Children series, that a number of these could really quite easily have been expanded out into a reasonable novel. I'm not a 400-pager, but, you know, somewhere around the 225, 250, 280 mark, and I think they could have... there was enough material there to be able to handle all that.
Yeah, they would have benefited from that, yeah.
And this is certainly one of them. There's a couple of others which are certainly of around about the right length, but there's a lot going on in this, and as you say, that some of it gets skimmed over. I still enjoy these. When I come across them and I find another one's out, I'll go out and have a look for it and read them, because I think McGuire's doing some good work here. It's an interesting take on the portal fantasy theme with the children having returned and desperately wanting to go back. They have to try and wait and hope that their doorway opens or appears for them again, because they can't just snap their fingers and call it up.
It's a clever premise.
It is. It's quite good, and it gives that sense of anguish and longing and questing for the actual portal to arise again or arrive, and so. All the children here are maladjusted. They basically just don't fit. Some of them are really completely off the planet. But it's fun stuff. But as you say, there's probably a bit too much talking that goes on. And anyway, I would recommend these. If you like this sort of... If you like a variant on a portal fantasy, these ones are quite good to go in and have a look at. I'd recommend them. You're not going to lose out by reading these, that's for sure. Some of the others you could basically skip and not really have too much to worry about. And the next one that I'm going to talk about is one of those. This is Fina by Nino Cipri, an author that I'd never come across before. This is another one that was nominated for both the Locust, Hugo and Nebula Awards this year, so you'd think that it resonated with enough people to be considered for all three of those. It starts off, this particular novella starts off with an elderly customer goes missing in a big box furniture store, rather like IKEA. This is like IKEA on steroids, and there's some funny little bits just in here. We'll get to that. Anyway, so if you think of IKEA, you think of the IKEAs that I know, I get into them, I hate them. Walking round and round and round and round, I always try and find my cutoff points and try to get through quickly because I don't want to have to do the full run all the way right through. Anyway, so this woman goes missing, as you could expect. You know, it's pretty easy to go missing in a large furniture store like IKEA. And two minimum wage employees, Ava and Jules, are tasked with trying to find her. You know, they're basically, I don't know, the manager just basically picks them out and says, right, you two can do this. Now, unfortunately for the two of them, this involves navigating their way through a maze of interdimensional portals, because what's happened is, again, we've got another portal fantasy. What's happened here is this elderly customer's wandered through a portal that she didn't know was there. And while Ava and Jules know about these particular portals, they, again, don't know when they're going to appear. But they turn up and they find out where this customer went through, and they try and follow her through. Now, they have a little device, which is called a FINA, F-I-N-N-A, although I don't remember what the acronym stands for. And this is supposed to point an arrow in the direction of the lost item. So you tell it what it is you want, and it sort of points you to it. Now, generally, this arrow is going to be green when the best fit, that is, the actual person that you're trying to find or the actual item you're trying to find is located, and yellow when the next best fit, that is, a variant of the person in another world, is found. Because, of course, if you wander from one particular world into another, you've still got your counterpart in this other world, but it isn't actually you. It's a variant of you in this other particular world. Other particular world. Now, added to their major problem of trying to track down this this woman is the fact that Jules and Ava have just broken up from an intense relationship. Ava, one of them identifies as female, and one of them identifies as they, using the particular pronouns. So you've got to be careful about which ones they're talking about and who's doing what. Anyway. They go through a large number of adventures. Oh, I don't know. It's amusing and readable, but not really of a level that would make it onto 3 awards ballots. I didn't quite get that. And you sort of have to wonder, there's not enough story here to carry on the whole thing for this amount of time. And they do seem to spend a lot of time anguishing about their relationship, which if it had been anything else, you know, other than the sexuality of the two that are there, you would have thought it was just soppy and rather ridiculous. And here I sort of wonder whether it's been picked up because of that relationship rather than the worth of the story. Yeah, as I said, it's amusing and readable, but a bit throwaway, and, you know, I've pretty much forgotten it already. And I only read it about 6 weeks ago, and I'm struggling to remember anything about it. So I only gave it 3.3 out of 5, and Cypri will have to do something better for me to follow their work in future, I think. At this stage, no, I didn't really think terribly much of this.
Oh, well, interesting.
Unfortunate.
All right. Yeah. All right. Now I'm going to go on. This is my last one. This is The Empress of Salt and Fortune by Nhi Vo, N-G-H-I-V-O. And I like this story a lot, which is interesting because I didn't expect to like it at all. Because in general, I dislike a lot of fantasy, and it made me wonder sort of really, it's a bit of a digression, but it made me wonder a bit about what constitutes the genre of fantasy these days. Because although this story is set in an alternate world, a different world than ours, it's kind of a medieval Asian-like country, could be China, could be Japan, perhaps similar to those countries anyway. Although it's set in an alternate world, the fantastic or magical elements take a very minor, almost non-existent role in the plot. There's some talk of sorcerers, and there's a brief ghostly apparition near the start of the story, but that's about it. Grant you that there's an intelligent talking bird which accompanies the protagonist, but that isn't a very fantastic concept. So none of this makes it a bad story by any means, and as I say, I really liked it, but I'm puzzled, as I've said here on the podcast before, just how we define what fantasy is these days. Is it just something that's set in a different world? Is that enough to make it a piece of fantasy? Not sure. Anyway, let's leave all that aside. So now, Perry has already spoken about this novella on the podcast before. In episode 53, he talked about it and its sequel. So I'll try not to duplicate what he said too much, but I'll just give you my spin on it. So what we might call the outer story is fairly simple. The cleric Chi, C-H-I-H, I presume is how you pronounce it, Chi, has been sent by their monastery to discover what historical records and artifacts remain in a place called Thriving Fortune, which is set by a lake in a rural area of the country. And this was an estate where the discarded wives of the emperor were exiled to keep them out of the way if they weren't executed. It's where Inyo, the last emperor's wife, was sent many years ago when she had given birth to her son, produced an heir. Now, Inyo was a foreign bride from the northern country of An, A-N-H, and presumably she was married for diplomatic reasons. And she's generally despised by the court, who think she's ugly and out of place, before she's banished. Now, the residence called Thriving Fortune has for decades been locked away since she was sent there, and entry forbidden, and only recently has access to the location being permitted again. So at Thriving Fortune, Chi, who as a cleric is considered to be non-gendered, so we refer to Chi as they, discovers an old woman still living in the residence. And she tells Chi to call her Rabbit, which is a nickname she was given because of her prominent front teeth. And she was a servant to Inyo and almost a friend. And it seems that she's been living at Thriving Fortune ever since she first came. Chi and her their companion, the intelligent bird Almost Brilliant, start to do their work of going through the artifacts remaining at the residence. And as they encounter and carefully describe various objects, they ask Rabbit about them. And Rabbit explains what the object is and tells the story behind it, and as part of that, telling her own story. So I really liked how the inner story, which is the story of this exiled wife Inyo, is told through these objects, and it leads up to what to me was an unexpected conclusion anyway, as to where she took that. I thought it was really nicely done, the way the story was told. So Inyo, we discover, was not content with her lot as the discarded wife, and through very clever stratagems managed to inspire and control an invasion of the empire from her birth country, An. So I like it a lot. The characters of Chi and Rabbit, and vicariously the character of Inyo, are well depicted, and there's a good deal of charm, I say, in the way that the story is told. So, yeah, I liked it. Recommend it.
Yeah, I did as well. I liked the magical bird, Almost Brilliant, as well. What a great name.
Funny,
this, yeah. This is Almost Brilliant. Oh, great. He just sits on the shoulder and has a few things to say here and there. I agree with you in the way that the story, the inner story, is unlayered. It just a little bit comes out a bit at a time. Not a lot happens in this, but it's just beautifully told, and it's a good length for this. I thought it worked very well. I thought
showed, it wouldn't want to have been any longer.
No, it showed I thought it showed a lot of mastery of the form, and the idea of withholding information for as long as you possibly can, so that the reader gets this expectation building up of something coming, and then when it does, it goes, oh, okay, I wasn't expecting that. And that's a good thing, because I don't reckon there's very little of that in any of the other novellas at all.
No.
I think this one, if we could talk about things all together, I think this one is my favourite of the whole six.
Yeah, it'll get my vote.
And it will be getting my vote as well, but I don't think it'll win.
No.
I think Ring Shout will probably win. I would think that there seems to be a... Got to be careful how we basically say this, because we can come across this as being, as you said earlier, we have to take this from the perspective of our cultural backgrounds, the white privilege that we have. But if you've got to look at them as stories, that's it.
Which is the way you've got to look
just
at them.
Just as stories in terms of how they come together. And while Ring Shout has a lot to say, I think it undermines its own premise. And I think there's just too much, oh, I need a sword. Oh, here's one. Bang.
Yeah,
got one.
That's right.
What? This is real Deus Ex Machina stuff. You know, just drag something out of the air whenever you feel like it and fix it up. There's no artifice in this particular story of Empress and Sultan Fortune. It just flows through. He's attempting to work out a history of the Empress Inyo, and it slowly reveals itself through the questions that she asks of Rabbit and what they discover in this house. It's beautifully done, and it just gets to the end and you think, I enjoyed reading that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And as you recall, though, I did have the second one in that series, which isn't nominated, and it isn't as good as this, unfortunately. I found this one to be exquisitely paced and really good, and I'll be voting for Empress of Salt and Fortune, but I'm pretty certain that Ring Shout will win. I would think that I think Riot Baby will get up pretty high, But I think that Empress and Soul and Fortune will probably end up being third or fourth in the final reckoning. So that's the Hugo novellas for this year. We shall keep track of this and see how we go in terms of our choices. And as I said at the beginning, that there are some of these that we think are going to win and some that we'll vote for, and they're not necessarily the same thing.
The same, right?
As in this case. Okay, I think that's done.
All right. So what else have you been reading?
What else have I been reading? You remember back a little while ago where I was lamenting the fact that I was running out of what I called comfort reads?
Yes.
I was talking about the fact that I used to read the Adam Hall Quiller series, which I really enjoyed, because they were light, they were light action thrillers, made you think about it a little bit, but it was so, I thought they were just really well written, short, you know, 225 pages at most, you know, a fantastic paperback size. And I'd been lamenting the fact that I hadn't been able to find anything for a while. Well, I think I may have found one or two series which might be able to fit that spot for me now. The first of these is the Slow House series by Mick Herron. Now, the Slow House series in this instance is spelled S-L-O-U-G-H. Or slow, however you want to pronounce it. The reason, Slough or Slow House is basically where the British intelligence banishes its almost agents, the ones that start out to being an agent but stuff up somehow.
Okay.
You know, they basically mess up by talking too much to somebody when they've had too much to drink, or by failing a major assessment, as our lead character does here. And because they basically have to, he's given the task of tracking a pseudo terrorist in the London Underground, and he messes it up for one particular reason, because he gets the description wrong, and he follows the wrong person until he finds out that it is the wrong person. Then realise, oh, I've actually seen the right one, and then goes chasing after them. But according to the assessment, he's a bit too late, and $1 billion worth of damage and 150 people are killed, and so he's banished. Now, some other people also have left sensitive material on a tube train. It's not very good when you take your work home in on a hard drive or a USB stick, and you forget it on the train, and somebody picks it up and looks at it and goes, "Oh, this would be really interesting. I wonder if the BBC would like to see this." So rather than sending it back to the people that it belongs to, send it off to the media. So anyway, these guys are banished, so they're no hopers theoretically. The name of this particular house comes from the fact that these people are referred to as SLOW, S-L-O-W, agents. And that's where so they work in this place called SLOW or Slough House. Now, this is run by a bloke called Jackson Lamb, who on the face of it seems to be very competent about what he does. And so you start thinking, why has he been banished? Has he just been put over here just to keep them in check and make sure they don't go anywhere, don't reveal anything they shouldn't reveal, and maybe possibly get them up to the point where they can get some redemption and get back into the mainstream? Don't know. Maybe we'll find out. Anyway, this particular establishment doesn't run operations at all. It pushes paper around, analysing useless data and generally passing the time, you know, either waiting until they get completely forgotten about or get forced to resign, or the British intelligence organisation is just actually hoping they'll resign and go away and never come back and never darken their door ever again. But anyway, somehow the guys in Slough House get wind of a case of a young Pakistani who's been allegedly kidnapped by a British ultra-right-wing group who threatened to behead him and live-stream the act. This is based on the fact that the book was written, it's published in about 2010, so it comes around about the time of those July bombings on the buses way back when, about 10, 12 years ago in Britain.
2007, I think.
Yeah, that's right. So it was written just after that and published in 2010. And so this British ultra-right-wing group theoretically their aim is to have an act of reprisal against well, just anybody, pick somebody that isn't your colour, and they just happen to pick this guy who's a Pakistani. The difficulty that they've got that they weren't aware of is that he's the nephew of the second highest ranking Pakistani in Pakistani intelligence. And so things are sort of flowing around all over the place and nobody really knows what's going on. Now, the guys in Slough House have been thwarted at every turn by Regent's Park, which is where the intelligence IQ is. But Lamb's unlikely crew have a tendency to force their way into the centre of the action, and things roll along really quite nicely. It's sort of, it ticks along. This is the first in this particular series. There's about eight or so.
Mm-hmm.
It's been muted as being converted into a TV series coming up.
Yeah.
And I have this feeling that I read somewhere that Gary Oldman is going to play the part of Jackson Lamb. So this isn't Le Carre level. And, of course, as you remember, Gary Oldman played Smiley so brilliantly in that film adaptation of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Mm.
And that was 8-10 years ago now. It was a long time ago.
I guess so, yeah.
It's not up to Le Carre's level, but it's funny. It's enjoyable. It's a fast-paced espionage novel. You enjoy it. Yeah, I'll be reading more of these. I gave it 3.8 out of 5. I think, as I said, there's 8 or 10 of these in the series now. Some of them are novella length, but worthwhile checking out.
Hmm.
Right. If you like this sort of thing, of course. If you don't,
sure,
don't bother.
Don't bother. All right, this is, okay, my next book is a bit of a change of pace all around. It's a non-fiction book, for a start. And I'm going to have serious problems describing it, but I'll do my best. So this is Helgoland by Carlo Rovelli. Helgoland. Now, the author, Carlo Rovelli, is an Italian theoretical physicist who's written a number of popular books about science and associated philosophy of science. And he's got a really clear, engaging style. And if anyone can make the difficult areas of science understandable and interesting, it would be him. But some of these areas are, well, they're difficult. So in this book, Helgoland, he talks about the interpretation of quantum mechanics, something which has baffled the greatest minds in the history of science. There's no doubt that quantum physics works. In fact, it's the most accurate theory we've ever known, enabling predictions to an astonishing degree of accuracy. And it's today we take it for granted, and it's used in thousands of practical applications. But what does it mean? That's far harder. So in this book, and there's all these bizarre consequences of quantum physics, which which really make your head spin. So anyway, in this book, Rovelli starts with the time in 1925 when Werner Heisenberg retreated to the island of Helgoland, seeking relief from the terrible hay fever he suffered from. This island apparently doesn't have any plants that produce pollen. So there, roving over the rocks, he came up with an approach to the puzzling results that physicists were coming up with in studying the behaviour of subatomic particles. Now, I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to do justice to Heisenberg's breakthrough. You'll just have to read the book. But I'll try to give you a spin of the rest of the book. But Rovelli uses the history of the development of thought about quantum matters to spin off his own thoughts. And Rovelli concentrates on the personal, on the individual people involved in discovering these things. There are no equations, never fear. And on the way, he digresses into several areas, including the philosophical and political battles of the Bolsheviks, including a very entertaining chapter about a remarkable man called Alexander Bogdanov and the sort of furious debates he had with Lenin about materialism. And Rovelli criticizes many of the popular approaches to quantum paradoxes, like Schrödinger's cat. We know the story of Schrödinger's cat. I don't have to go into any detail about that, do I? You know, the idea that you've got this box with a cat in it and there's a quantum device that decides whether it gets killed or not. But if you don't know what the result is, you know, is the cat alive? Is the cat dead? Anyway, he criticizes many of the approaches to explaining this sort of phenomenon, such as the many worlds concept, in which the universe splits into two every time there's a quantum event like the cat being killed or not. And he sort of really disses that and puts forward his own approach, which is what they call the relational interpretation of quantum physics, which requires us to think about the world in a very different way, sort of really take a very different perspective on the way the world is. In this theory, things and their properties only exist in terms of their relations. Things and their properties only exist in the terms of their relations or their interactions with other things. And beyond that, there is no there. Everything is just to do with the way things relate to each other. And on the way, it's very interesting to read. On the way, Revelli quotes Shakespeare. He refers to Kim Stanley Robinson's novels. And he even includes a relevant quote from Douglas Adams, which I will quote. So this is Douglas Adams. "The fact that we live at the bottom of a deep gravity well, on the surface of a gas-covered planet, going around a nuclear fireball 90 million miles away, and think this to be normal, is obviously some indication of how skewed our perspective tends to be." So, I really need to reread this book half a dozen times before I might start to really understand it. But it's very readable. And that's a reflection on me, not Revelli, who I think just writes superbly. It's well worth reading. Anyway, that's that book.
Quantum mechanics did me at university.
Oh, it does your head.
Oh, really, it does. Totally. I mean, basically people say to you that if you think you understand quantum mechanics, you obviously don't. Because all you can do is just know what the outcomes are going to be. You can't actually understand what it's doing. Some people say they do, but I don't get it. I just don't.
So you should read this book because it's interesting the take he makes on it, which is, you know, the fact that this confusion is about how we generally perceive the world in general. You just have to spin it. Yeah, it's clever.
The more things that come out of physics keep on telling you that everything you see around you isn't really what's there. You might be able to touch things.
Well, this is the Buddhist or Hindu concept of Maya, isn't it? The world is an illusion.
Yeah,
and there's a sense of that.
Well, it certainly is from the quantum mechanical point of view. When you look at it, that you know we have theories that tell you what happens at the very large and in the everyday, but when you get down to the very small, everything just sort of comes apart and doesn't sort of make a lot of sense. It's all weird, and it was just never going to be the thing that I got into. Just couldn't get my head around it. I think that was probably the problem. I think I was just trying to get my head around it too much, and trying to say, well, I've got to understand this to be able to determine what goes on. Maybe that isn't what you need. Anyway,
I think that's right.
All right, I'm back to another thriller. I told you this is comfort food or comfort reading that I had. This one is The Kill Artist by Daniel Silva. Now, this is number one in the author's Gabriel Allon series. 3 or 4 years ago, I read the second in this particular series, thinking it was the first one, but had just misread the series of novels, the titles in the series, and I sort of picked the wrong one. I thought that one was pretty good when I read that one, so I thought, well, I have to go back and read the first one. This will give me all the background about this particular character, Gabriel Allon, and I should be able to, you know, sort of fill it in and then be able to work my way forward. Now, as I said, this is number one in the series. I think there's something like 18 or 20 that he's now written. He's turning out about one a year. This one was originally published in 2001. So as you can see, it's had time to get about 20 of them out. Now, Gabriel Allon, when the book starts, is an ex-Israeli intelligence officer. Well, he's Israeli, but he's an ex-intelligence officer, if you know what I mean. He's now living in Cornwall and working as a restorer of fine paintings. And you think, oh, come on, this is a bit over the top, isn't it? How could this intelligence officer be a restorer of fine paintings? And then slowly comes out in the book, and you get a background of Gabriel Allon. He was his parents were both. He was born in France to Jewish parents. His mother was an artist. So then he picked up his appreciation of fine art. When the Israeli intelligence got a hold of him and realised that he was the perfect character for them to be able to use all the way through Europe, because he spoke, you know, sort of 8 or 10 languages or whatever, which isn't out of the ordinary. I mean, I know people that speak five or six and quite regularly and don't have any problem about it. I mean, the fact that he's just a little bit better, he can speak a couple more, doesn't seem to be too out of the ordinary, and but it's enough to catch the attention of the Israeli intelligence. And so what they did was they trained him up as a restorer of fine paintings, and that was his cover when he was intelligence agent. So they got him, and he got to be very, very good at it. And so good, in fact, that he's probably one of the top half dozen in the world, because he had the talent, he had the intelligence, and he had the backing of everybody that put him into those places where you're going to be able to learn the art and the craft from the best people in Europe. Anyway, so something's obviously happened in the past. He's basically got out of the Mossad. He's no longer working for them, and he's over there in Cornwall. The book then moves over to Paris, where the Israeli ambassador is assassinated in with a bomb that's thrown underneath his car. And he's assassinated by what the person that Mossad identifies by the name of Tariq, T-A-R-I-Q, who's a terrorist mastermind who has been a thorn in the side of Mossad for years. Now, due to the fact that the Israeli ambassador has been assassinated, the Israeli prime minister is a little bit annoyed about Mossad allowing this to happen. And so they reinstate the old head of Israeli intelligence, a person by the name of Arish Shamron. Now, he decides that he's going to recruit Alon to come back and kill Tariq, because Alon and Tariq have a lot of history. Alon at one stage had killed Tariq's brother, and Tariq then retaliated by killing Alon's son and maiming his wife. So there's a lot of personal history between the two of these. And so Alon decides that, yes, he's definitely going to... He's going to undertake this task, thinking that this will be the end of it. You know, he'll just get this, he'll kill this guy, and then there'll be no more. So this is an espionage thriller in the grand style of those European espionage novels that zigzags across Europe, over through the Middle East, backwards and forwards, and ends up in Canada and the United States. So the plot is rather intricate. I don't want to go into too much detail, because otherwise you just give too much away. And the whole thing about thrillers is what's going on the roller coaster ride. So the plot's intricate, it's global, but it's also very personal, because it deals with Alon's. He doesn't want to be doing this anymore. He just wants to get out. He wants to leave this world behind. And he wants to get back to restoring his paintings, because that's what he loves very much. But he doesn't have a choice in this instance. He's got an opportunity to have revenge on Tariq. And he wants to gain that revenge if he can. Now, most of the characters are basically one or maybe two-dimensional. Alon is a bit more fleshed out. So is Tariq. You get a bit more of his background. But it's the plot that really matters with these particular novels, and that really hums along. And it's one of those ones where I enjoyed this quite a lot. I mean, it's not a brilliant book by any stretch of the imagination, but at 400 pages or so, it just hums along very nicely. Mm. And I think that I won't have any trouble about going back in and picking up one or two of these a year and reading them when I feel as though my reading's falling away, because I'm getting bored with too much introspection and soul searching. I want people to go out chasing other people, you know, like a good action movie. As I've said in the past, there are times when, regardless of how much good food you eat, every now and again you want a really good pizza. And this is a really good pizza.
Yeah. All right, good. Okay, well, my last book is also a thriller. This is Say You're Sorry by Michael Robotham. And this is another in Robotham's series of thrillers featuring his psychologist hero, Joe O'Loughlin, and Joe's friend, Vincent Ruiz, who is a retired cop. I think this is number 6 or 7 in the series, depending on which books you count as being in or out of the series. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So this one begins with a first-person account, which is written by young Piper Hadley. And we soon learn that she's being kept captive somewhere, along with her friend Tash. And their captor is a man they call George, although that's certainly not his real name. And they've been in his power for 3 years. Now, when they were first taken, he let them watch the television accounts of the hunt for them after their disappearance. The media dubbed them the Bingham Girls. It was quite a media sensation at the time. But the search was futile and petered out, and now they've largely been forgotten. So eventually it's sort of assumed that the girls must just have run away from home and just haven't been in contact since. So we keep getting excerpts from Piper's notes through the book, and later, not her notes, but just her thoughts. Anyway, she's got a continuing theme through the book. So then we switch to the point of view of Gerald Loughlin. He's now separated from his wife, really after the traumatic events in the earlier book, Shatter, which is a shattering book and well worth reading. So now he's in Oxford for a conference, over a weekend for a conference, and he has his teenage daughter, Charlie, with him on what he's calling a father-daughter bonding weekend. But it's partially to keep her away from an older boy that Joe's wife, Julianne, disapproves of. So he's here for this conference, and she's sort of wandering around town entertaining herself. But inevitably, there's a police case, and Joe gets pulled into this case, which is baffling the local authorities. Now, what's happened is a local farmhouse was set ablaze a few nights ago, but it didn't burn down completely. The weather at the time is freezing, and there have been frequent snowfalls. And in fact, there was a heavy blizzard the night of the murders. And the bodies of the owners, a man and a woman, were found in the house. The man bludgeoned to death, the woman found tied to the bed upstairs. And that's where the fire started, and the suspicion is that the woman was set alight. The police have a suspect who's an intellectually disabled man who used to work for the couple. And Loughlin's brought in to do a psychological assessment of this bloke. But after he does the assessment, Loughlin finds it highly unlikely that this person has the mental capacity to commit such a murder. So he goes looking for other explanations. Now, the case becomes more complex when the body of a young woman is found frozen into the ice of a pond a few miles away. It's freezing weather, and this pond is frozen solid since she fell in. And now Loughlin thinks this body is somehow connected to what happened in the farmhouse, which is not, say, not far away from this pond. And it's eventually determined that the body in the pond is that of Tash, one of the Bingham girls who disappeared 3 years ago. So the questions immediately arise, where has she been in the intervening period? And where is Piper Hadley? And is there a chance that Piper Hadley is still alive? So Robotham's always very good at keeping up the tension, and he, at the same time, he weaves in the personal tribulations of his protagonist very well, I think. At one point, O'Loughlin's daughter, Charlie, absconds from Oxford to be with her boyfriend in London, which causes Joe a huge amount of stress and gets him into deep trouble with his estranged wife. I was a bit disappointed by the resolution of the book, the revelation of who done it, which didn't seem to me to be adequately foreshadowed. It just sort of comes out of the blue. Oh, you sort of go, oh, it was him, was it? Okay. But, you know, maybe I was just missing the clues. But anyway, an enjoyable read. As you say, sort of comfort read sort of material. Yeah,
he's been doing some pretty good work for quite a long period of time now.
Yeah.
You sort of think, though, that is this the most recent of his books with this particular character or not?
No. It's I'm not sure exactly when it was published, but it would have been published, you know, at least 5-6 years ago.
Okay. All right. So he's done others with Joe Loughlin since, because it sounded like this one he was sort of running out of ideas almost, because a lot of these things seem to be. I think there's some similar sort of themes that run through Robotham's work, especially Young Women in Peril seems to be one of them. I mean, I'm not denigrating him because of it. I'm just saying that there's a commonality there that I've noticed. But he handles it very, very well. And all of his books that I've read, I've greatly enjoyed. I think that he's a superb craftsman, and he knows how to get the plot moving and how to bring the thrills in, and where to how to keep the tension up. Which is always a good thing, and I think he's certainly one that's worthwhile reading, David.
Yeah, indeed. I'm just looking up. Say You're Sorry was published in 2012.
Okay.
So what's that? 9 years ago.
Yeah, it's a while. All right. Yeah. Okay.
And there are 1, 2, 3 more in the series after that.
Okay. All right. Well, that's about it, I think, David. I think we're just about finished up for the day. We're over our hour, so it's time to let the poor listener
go back to their occupations.
Yes, and sort of not have to put up with us rabbiting on about nonsense as we normally do. We're not terribly sure what we're going to be doing next.
No, we haven't really decided.
No, we haven't.
No, it'll be a surprise. It'll be a surprise.
It will be a surprise. We'll have to sort of think about it. Try and do something a little bit different. Think about something else. All right. Okay. Well, anyway, whatever the situation is, we will be talking again in a fortnight, David, and
we will,
and we'll see you then. Okay.
We'll see you then.
Okay. Bye. Bye. Bye.